Welcome to Tom's Sidecast, and I'm your host, Tom Kennedy. Now today we're going to talk about something that I know is the bane of many biology students, and that's chemistry. But you know what? I really like chemistry. And in fact, I even started out as a chemical engineer a long time ago, back in undergraduate. So I've always had this affinity for chemistry. And I think one of the reasons why we don't like chemistry is because it's abstract. We don't actually see a molecule. And in fact, we have to draw diagrams just to model what an atom looks like, or a molecule, or anything. So for a lot of people, you know, chemistry is this kind of abstract thing. We don't think it has any real application in our everyday life. But I'm hoping today, in this chemistry of life, that I can help you come away with a little bit of an appreciation for chemistry. I might not flip anybody to chemistry major, but that's okay. My goal is to just show that chemistry is important, that it matters, and it doesn't have to be this really scary thing. Okay, let me make the case for chemistry. Of course, I'm gonna tell you it's important, but it really is. I mean, think about this. If you're interested in how your body works, it's all chemistry, right? I mean, right down at the cellular level. So we don't know exactly how many molecules are made by the human body. We're still learning. There are estimates that we make up to 100,000 unique molecules, and we're still looking for new ones. Now, most molecules belong to one of four groups of macromolecules found in all living organisms. And you're probably familiar with these. I mean, these are the carbohydrates, proteins, nucleic acids, and lipids. Now, in addition to these four molecules, these are called the macromolecules. Macro just means large. There's also various organic molecules called the vitamins and other ones known as pigments that serve a variety of functions to help keep us healthy. Now, our cells, they make the vast majority of molecules they need from smaller building blocks. And our diet, that supplies us with the raw materials and energy we need to make the molecules that keep us going. And let me remind you, we are all made of chemicals. We have these elements, and they combine to form molecules. And tens of thousands of different types of molecules come together to form cells. And if you remember, the cell is a basic unit of life, and life is an emergent property of a complex system relying on lots of different types of chemical reactions. So, life is an emergent property relying on chemical reactions. Now, as I just said, we need to eat. And the food we eat provides us with the building blocks, the raw materials that we need to make all kinds of chemicals. And our food also supplies us with the energy we need to build complex molecules, create order, and maintain homeostasis, and carry out a wide variety of other functions that we do on a daily basis, like walking or studying. Well, let's get started here. Because life is based on chemistry, and we eat foods to basically sustain ourselves, you know, a little knowledge of chemistry, it'll help us understand things like why a simple carb is a quick source of energy compared to a complex carbohydrate. And in fact, you'll even know what a carbohydrate is, or why fructose and glucose are treated differently in your body. Want to know why saturated fats are not good for you, but an unsaturated fat like olive oil is? Guess what? Chemistry helps. There are a few take-home points I hope you get out of this podcast today. One point is shape matters, and it matters at all scales. We're talking from molecules all the way up to an entire animal. Subtle differences and the shape of a molecule, like the difference between fructose and glucose, matter because our bodies see and treat these molecules differently. Also, the difference between a saturated fat and an unsaturated fat. It's a small difference, but it really matters for how it affects our health. A second point that I hope we get over is something called chemophobia. Chemophobia, chemo means chemical, phobia means fear of. If you have chemophobia, you are afraid of chemicals, and this is a growing problem So what happens is you see a chemical listed on your food. You don't know what it is. It's got a long name and you fear it. And in some ways, chemophobia is a little irrational. You know, fruits and vegetables, they contain thousands of chemicals, most you've never heard of. And perhaps you have heard of some molecules like carotenoids. These are pigments that make carrots orange, and we know they're good for you because they're related to beta-carotene and vitamin A. Or other molecules you may not have heard of, like anthocyanins. Anthocyanins make blueberries blue, and they're really good for you. Other chemicals, in contrast, like alkaloids, you want to avoid alkaloids. They're found in hemlock plants, and hemlock tea, it will kill you. And if you don't believe me, you can ask Socrates. He supposedly drank hemlock tea to kill himself. So the point here is, just because you don't recognize a chemical doesn't mean it's necessarily bad for you. Chemicals can be incredibly toxic or they can be beneficial. But here is my third take-home point, and this is important. Any chemical can be harmful if there's too much of it. And in fact, each chemical has what is called an LD50. LD stands for lethal dose, and 50 is that dose which would kill 50% of the population. So something like tetrodotoxin, it's really, really, really toxic. It only takes micrograms to kill somebody. And at the other extreme is water. And most of us don't think of water as being toxic. But guess what? Like any chemical, water has an LD50. If you drink about 6 liters of water in an hour, you can actually die from something known as hyponatremia. You drink so much water that your body gets out of an electrolyte balance. You get a chemical imbalance and you can die. So even too much water can kill you. And this is important, especially for evaluating things like, should you eat organic foods because you're worried about pesticide residues, especially glyphosate, which comes from Roundup. Well, you may have heard in the news recently that Monsanto got sued because glyphosate caused cancer. It may have, I don't really know, but I can tell you this, that the amount of glyphosate that you get on your vegetables is safe. It's not going to cause you any problems. Now, that doesn't mean that you want to go and drink glyphosate, because in that case, you would exceed the recommended daily allowance of it, and then you can get sick from it. And that goes for anything. Caffeine. I love caffeine. I mean, I start up my mornings off with a Diet Pepsi. Give me some caffeine. But too much caffeine will kill you. So the important point here is the dose makes the poison. In small amounts, many of the things that we get in our diet are good for us. Too much of it, even too much vitamin A, is a bad thing. And my last point with chemistry, man-made versus natural. Just because a chemical is made naturally doesn't necessarily mean it's good or bad for you. Take, for example, fructose. Doesn't matter if it was made by a plant. Yep, plants actually make lots of fructose. You get it when you eat fruits. That's what makes them taste sweet, along with glucose. But you could take that fructose, whether it's made by a plant or in a factory, synthetically or artificially by humans. Your body will never know the difference between a glucose molecule made by photosynthesis in a plant or artificially in a factory. It doesn't matter. The molecules are the same. Now that we got this introduction out of the way, let's move on and talk about these four macromolecules, the carbohydrates, the proteins, the lipids, and the nucleic acids. And I'll finish off with a few vitamins at the end of this podcast. Now, if you listen very closely, it's not your imagination. There is a rooster in the background of this recording. He's right outside my window. I tried to turn my microphone away from him, but he is not moving. So I apologize for the rooster crowing. Makes you feel like you're a little bit more out in the country, I suppose. All right. Well, let's get started with these carbohydrates. You know, most of us are familiar with carbohydrates. Of course, they're made up of carbon, oxygen, and hydrogen. These things are hydrophilic. Hydro means water. Phile means loving. So these are water-loving molecules that can dissolve in water by forming hydrogen bonds with water. I know, hydrogen bonds. Look that up if you don't remember it. Now, carbohydrates, you know, most of us know that they're a source of energy, and we get a lot of energy from carbs. And in fact, they're the first source of energy used by our cells. So simple carbohydrates, if you drink a soda or eat some fruit, you get glucose and fructose, and they are quickly absorbed into the blood. And if you have glucose, it's taken up by our muscle cells and our brains. That's why whenever you eat some simple carbs, you get that quick burst of energy. And your brain basically uses glucose as its main source of energy. And 20% of your energy budget goes to your brain every day. But carbohydrates serve many more functions than just a quick source of energy. For instance, they form a complex carbohydrate known as cellulose. And cellulose forms tough cell walls around plant cells. Now, of course, you can eat vegetables, and they have cellulose around their cell walls. But the difference between like a spinach leaf and a 2x4 is that the 2x4 cell wall has lignin in it, which makes it really strong. But let's go on. You know, cellulose, even though it makes a cell wall of plants, it's also really important for your digestive health. For one, it keeps things moving through your gut. And second, we can't break down cellulose. And in fact, no animal can break down cellulose, but it's still really important. It's been thought that the cellulose, or the fiber in your foods from eating a lot of vegetables, creates a lot of habitat, maintaining a diverse and healthy gut microbiome. So make sure you get plenty of fiber in your diet. And outside of nutrition, if you're wearing cotton, or if you're using anything cotton in your life, cotton is also made up of cellulose fibers made by plants. Here's another use of carbohydrates that you may not be aware of. Have you ever wondered how your immune system knows how to attack a pathogen? I mean, how does it recognize yourself from something that's not you? We call that recognizing self from non-self. Well, it turns out the small carbohydrates called oligosaccharides. Now, oligo means short or few or many, and saccharide means sugar. So these are small sugars attached to proteins or fats in cell membranes. This allows your immune system to recognize the cells of your body from a foreign invader. And in fact, if you have an autoimmune disease, it's because your cells of your immune system cannot recognize the cells that are you. And the usefulness of carbohydrates doesn't stop there. Whenever we break down glucose, we create smaller molecules. And those smaller molecules, one of them is called pyruvate, another one is called acetaldehyde, those become building blocks for other molecules. And in fact, we can make a lot of the molecules we need. We can make a lot of our amino acids. We can make fats. We can even make glucose if we need it. And we do that by breaking down carbohydrates, using those smaller molecules as building blocks to make other macromolecules. It's pretty cool, isn't it? Like all the macromolecules, carbohydrates come in many shapes and sizes, but broadly speaking, they're either simple carbs or complex carbs. Now, simple carbs are made up of only one or two sugar molecules. So a monosaccharide, mono meaning one, saccharide having to do with sugar, a monosaccharide include things like glucose, fructose, galactose. You may not have heard galactose, but it's an important one. And these are all isomers of each other. So they have the same chemical formula, C6H12O6. So that means they have six carbons, 12 hydrogens, and six oxygens. But their shapes are different, which means they're treated differently in our body. Now, a disaccharide, di means two, two sugars, include things like sucrose. And sucrose is made by sticking a glucose molecule to a fructose molecule, or one called lactose. Lactose is glucose plus galactose. And those would be the simple carbohydrates. Now, complex carbohydrates are mostly made of just glucose, and they could be hundreds to thousands of glucose molecules long. Three common types of complex carbohydrates are starch, made by plants, think potato, rice, and pasta. Yep, those are mostly made of starch. Glycogen. Glycogen is made by animals and is stored mostly in our livers and in our muscles. And of course, one we've already talked about, cellulose. And cellulose has the distinction of being the most abundant organic molecule on the planet. In recent decades, Americans, and the rest of the world for that matter, have been getting larger. There's an obesity epidemic. And there are multiple reasons why our country has a growing rate of obesity. It's a very complex problem. There's no one single answer. However, there's been a growing concern that we have too much sugar in our diet. And that's true. I mean, we consume way too much sugar in our diet. Now, like I said, going back to one of my first points, something in small amounts is okay. A little bit of sugar here and there, a little bit of carbs, not bad. Too many carbs, that's a bad thing. And specifically, something known as high fructose corn syrup, HFCS, has come under fire recently. Now, a few decades ago, the beverage industry began using this high fructose corn syrup in their beverages. And this is about 55% fructose and 45% glucose. Now, we all know that glucose tastes sweet, but fructose is much sweeter. And these two molecules, remember, they have the same chemical formula, C6H12O6, but they are isomers. You see, glucose has a 6-membered ring, and fructose has a 5-membered ring. And our bodies see them differently. Whenever you take in glucose, it's absorbed by your intestines, gets into your bloodstream, and it causes your body to release insulin. And insulin is a hormone that causes your muscle cells and fat cells to bring in glucose. Now, if you're exercising, you're going to burn off the glucose for energy. You're going to release most of it as carbon dioxide and water. If you're not exercising, your fat cells will bring in glucose. It'll be converted to fat. And well, you know what happens from there. Now, fructose, on the other hand, does not cause an insulin response. Instead, it goes to the liver, where it will get broken down and repurposed into other molecules, including triglycerides, which are bad. So a diet high in fructose can actually lead to fatty liver disease, and it can lead to high triglycerides in your blood. And that's not good because it leads to vascular disease. Years ago, I had a really bad regular soda diet habit. I was drinking 2 or 3 Mountain Dews a day. And I went to go get my blood work done, and it came back with high triglyceride levels. And I'm like, wait a second, you know, I work out 3 to 5 times a week. I'm hiking 10 miles a week. How do I have high triglyceride levels? And the nurse goes, you drink soda, don't you? And I just was like, yeah, I do. So even though I was physically active with under 10% body fat, I still had high triglyceride levels from my soda habit. So I kicked my regular soda habit, switched it off for diet soda, and that's going to be the subject of another podcast because switching to diet soda has come with its own set of problems. I need to go back to drinking tea. But here's the point. I was drinking way too much high fructose corn syrup, like many Americans, and it was affecting my health. I just couldn't see it yet until I got my blood work done. And other studies have shown that fructose does cause more health problems than drinking just glucose. And in response to this, the beverage industry has talked about using real sugar or a throwback where they just use glucose. Okay. The problem here still remains. If you're drinking lots of soda, even if it's all glucose, is it as bad for you as all the fructose? No. But too much soda, too much sugar, glucose or fructose is a bad thing. Here's the other problem. They called it real sugar. Well, real sugar, that doesn't mean anything. Fructose is real sugar. Galactose is real sugar. Sucrose is real sugar. They are all real sugars. It doesn't matter if it's made by a plant through photosynthesis or in a factory. It's all real sugar. The origin doesn't matter. So I hope that helps out with the problem there. So avoid drinking a lot of soda and too many carbs in general. Now, while we're talking about health, let's move on to the next macromolecule. Let's talk about lipids. Lipids are a diverse group of molecules that include fats, waxes, oils, and different types of hormones like estrogen and testosterone. And lipids perform a variety of functions inside of our cells. Lipids are more than just fat molecules. But what they share in common is they're made mostly of carbon and hydrogen, And of course, this makes them hydrophobic. Hydro once again means water, and phobic means a phobia, a fear of. These are water-fearing molecules. Lipids don't dissolve in water. And you know this. You put some olive oil in with a balsamic vinaigrette for your salad. Yum. You know that the olive oil floats to the top of your salad dressing. And before you put it on your salad, you have to shake it up. And while we're talking about olive oil, let's start with fats. And you've probably heard a lot about fats lately. Like, some are good, some are bad. So when it comes to fats, I like to talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly. You know, from the Clint Eastwood spaghetti western, the good, bad, and the ugly. Bacon. Bacon. For some people, this is an incredibly tasty food that can be enjoyed by itself, used to enhance the food of almost anything, including burritos, pizza, hamburgers, even salads. Now, unfortunately, despite its amazing taste, bacon has a downside. You don't want to eat too much of it because it's loaded with saturated fat. So the question comes, what is saturated fat? Why is it considered unhealthy? And why is olive oil considered to be healthy? Once again, we're going to look at the chemistry of saturated fats and unsaturated fats to understand why olive oil is liquid at room temperature, but if you let that bacon grease cool to room temperature, it becomes a solid. And whether a fat is liquid or solid at room temperature is a function of its shape, and it also matters in terms of how our bodies see it and what it does inside of our arteries. Now let's start. You know, fats, they have this similar chemical structure. It's called a triglyceride. You see that word tri, that means three. Glyceride means glycerol, which is a three-carbon sugar-like molecule. And basically, you take a glycerol and you combine these long chains of carbons surrounded by hydrogens called a fatty acid. And these fatty acids typically have between 16 to 24 carbons in length, and they're all even numbered. But we're not going to get into that. Now, what makes one fat different from another is the length of the carbon chains and the number of hydrogens attached to the carbons. So these small changes affect the shape of the fat and alters how they work inside of our body. Now, fats, they store a lot of energy. Let's put this into perspective by comparing it to octane. If you've ever filled your car up, you've probably gone for the cheaper gas, right? And that's got an octane rating. Octane, octo means eight. Octane is a hydrocarbon, hydrogen and carbon. It's a chain of eight carbons surrounded by hydrogens. And you know it has a lot of energy. It powers our car. It's incredibly flammable. Don't smoke around gasoline. It's easily ignitable. Okay, well, a fatty acid is very similar to octane. It's a long chain of carbons surrounded by hydrogen. And, you know, octane only has eight carbons, right? But a fatty acid might have 16 or 24 carbons in length. That means a single fatty acid might have three times the amount of energy as octane. And not only that, there are three of those carbon chains attached to a glycerol, hence triglyceride. So as you can see, fats store a lot of energy. So even though fats are technically called triglycerides, which include oils, which are liquid, and regular fats, which are solid, I'm going to refer to these from now on as just fats. That's going to include oils as well, because the difference between bacon fat, which is solid, and olive oil is whether or not they are saturated or unsaturated. So let's talk about this. The good. Good fats are unsaturated fats. Here's an example. You have a salad, the light covering of olive oil mixed with a balsamic vinaigrette, and you got a small fillet of salmon. This is a healthy dinner. The olive oil is made of unsaturated fats, and the fish also has unsaturated fats, including omega-3. These are the good fats. And there are other sources of unsaturated fats like flaxseed oil, sunflower oil, peanut oil, safflower oil. See the trend here, right? They come from plants and cold water fish. Now, of course, if you go and put your oils in the freezer, they will solidify if you cool them down enough. So there's several questions. Why are they unsaturated? Why are they liquid at room temperature? And why are they considered healthy? And it turns out that the answer is related. Unsaturated. This means they are unsaturated in hydrogens. That also means they carry a little bit less energy. The reason why they have fewer hydrogens than, say, a saturated fat is because you've got your long chain of carbons, and those carbons are held together by covalent bonds. Oh no, here's that chemistry again. But remember that covalent bonds are sharing their valence electrons. And the valence electrons are these electrons in the outer shell. So of course, carbon has four valence electrons and forms four covalent bonds to fill its outer shell with eight electrons. So that means when you look at a fatty acid, that chain of carbons are all held together by covalent bonds. Now, in an unsaturated fat, there's going to be two carbon atoms, and they're going to share two covalent bonds. What that means is they're going to have two fewer hydrogens. And that carbon double bond, if it's in the right shape, will cause that tail, instead of being a long straight tail, to bend. And when that tail bends, it prevents the oil from stacking together and becoming a solid. It keeps it liquid. Think about it like this. You've got a book, and that book is full of paper. And imagine that each paper is a fatty acid. And a saturated fatty acid is going to be flat like that paper, and it stacks. And that's what allows it to be solid at room temperature. However, imagine if you started crinkling those papers up. They don't stack as well, do they? And in fact, if you tried to take your notebook and take all your paper out of it, wrinkle it up, you can hardly get any of that paper on your desk, maybe 10 pages. Stack it, you can get hundreds of pages. And that's kind of the analogy I like to use. That's the difference between the saturated fats and the unsaturated fats. Because the fatty acids are bent in an unsaturated fat, they don't form solids. They stay liquid at room temperature. And guess what? They also don't form plaques inside your arteries either. So that's why unsaturated fats are considered to be healthy, because they lower LDLs, they lower total cholesterol, and they help prevent the buildup of fats. That's pretty awesome, isn't it? Now, that being said, you don't need to go drink a whole bunch of olive oil every day. So saturated fats, are they good and they are healthy? But like I said, they're full of calories. Don't drink a whole bunch of it. Now the bad. I've already mentioned this one. These are the saturated fats. They are saturated in hydrogen. So the carbon chain has as much hydrogen as it can. And like I already said, these fatty acids are flat. They stack. They are solid at room temperature. And you've seen this. You cooked bacon. Well, maybe. But when you cook bacon, if you let the grease stay on the stove, after a few hours, it solidifies. And that's kind of what saturated fats do inside of our bodies. So they are considered unhealthy. Now, that being said, you don't have to give up bacon. You just don't need to eat a pound of it every day. That would be bad. Now, we got the good, the bad, and the ugly. That is a trans fat. Trans fats are unsaturated fats. Oh, I know. I just said unsaturated fats are the good. But these are in a slightly different conformation. Instead of the tails being bent, the tails are straight. So you get a straight fatty acid tail that stacks like a saturated fat, but it's got double bonds in there. And what do you think's harder to break? One bond or two? Yeah, if you said two, you're right. These fats not only act like saturated fats, they are harder for your body to break down. So the worst type of fat is trans fats. They have no nutritional value. Unfortunately, they're cheap to make. They have a long shelf life. And oh man, they can make that apple pie, the crust on it, so nice and flaky. And that's why people like to use it. But if you can avoid something in your diet, trans fats, we should actually ban them as a country and be done with them, because they are so bad for us. There is another type of fat that's very important. And this one is called a phospholipid. So phospho tells you there's a phosphate group attached to a lipid. Now, a phosphate is basically a phosphorus surrounded by a bunch of oxygens. And this is very hydrophilic. So when you make a phospholipid, it becomes an amphipathic molecule. That means it's got a region that's hydrophilic, that would be the phosphate group, and it's got a region that is hydrophobic. Now, basically, a phospholipid is you take a triglyceride, you remove one of the fatty acid tails, and replace it with a phosphate up on top. And we call it amphipathic because, like an amphibian, think amphibians live in both water and land, amphipathic is both hydrophobic and hydrophilic. Now, phospholipids are incredibly important to us because every single cell on this planet is surrounded by a cellular membrane made up of a phospholipid bilayer. You just learned what a phospholipid is. A bilayer means that there's two layers. The way it's formed is you got these phosphate heads. They're hydrophilic. They like water. They turn to the outside. And then those fatty acid tails, they are hydrophobic. They turn to the inside and they interact with each other. So if you have a cell membrane, the outside and the inside of the cell got those phosphate heads, and the inside of the membrane is a hydrophobic interior made up of those fatty acids. And that's important because cell membranes, they are the gatekeepers. They regulate what comes in and what exits the cell. And one of the ways they do this is by a property of the cell membrane called selective permeability. Now, to permeate something means you can move through it. So a cell membrane has selective permeability, which means only certain things can cross a cell membrane. And if you said, small hydrophobic substances because they can go through the hydrophobic interior, you'd be right. So small things like oxygen and carbon dioxide can easily cross a cell membrane. And even water can cross through a cell membrane because water molecules are small. But electrolytes, which are ions, they don't cross it as well. Neither do sugars or other larger hydrophilic molecules. So those types of molecules are brought in by transport proteins, and more on that in another podcast. But it's important to know that the cell membranes are made up of a phospholipid bilayer, which is very similar to a triglyceride. Now, for those of you that are no microbiology, the membranes of archaeans and bacteria and eukaryotes are really different. Well, let me make that clear. Bacteria and eukaryotes, which are what we are, our cell membranes are very, very, very similar. Archaeans, they're out there. They're very different. Still a phospholipid, usually a bilayer, but not always. But I'm not going to get into that now. Now for the last type of lipid I want to talk about. These are the sterols. You may not have heard of sterol, but I bet you've heard of cholesterol. I bet you've heard of testosterone or estrogen. Those are steroids. You see, humans, like all other animals, are multicellular organisms. We are made of trillions of independently living cells. Now, for this to work, they have to communicate with each other. They have to talk to each other. They've got to coordinate their activities. Now, we can do this using a nervous system for really fast communication, or we can send chemical signals, and those are the hormones. And of course, two important hormones are estrogen and testosterone. And we don't have a picture of it in front of you, but they are very similar to each other. And these are signaling molecules. Now, cholesterol. Cholesterol gets a bad rap because all you ever hear is that cholesterol is bad. But surprisingly, we need cholesterol. And in fact, our livers make cholesterol and it gets transported throughout our body to be put inside of our cells. Remember when I told you our cells are surrounded by a cellular membrane? Well, those membranes have to maintain the right fluidity. They can't be too liquid. They can't be too solid. And one of the ways we maintain proper fluidity is by putting cholesterol in them. So our bodies need cholesterol. Now, wait, this is a lipid. It's hydrophobic. So the question is, how does a hydrophobic molecule get transported throughout our blood? The answer is you pack them in proteins. And you may have heard of LDLs and HDLs. These are low-density lipoproteins, and high-density lipoproteins. So I know it's often called the good cholesterol and the bad cholesterol, whereas good cholesterol are your HDLs, the high-density lipoproteins, and the bad cholesterol are the LDLs, or low-density lipoproteins. But those aren't really cholesterol molecules. They're proteins that help move cholesterol throughout your body. Now, the LDLs, for low-density lipoproteins, what they do is they carry cholesterol from your liver to your cells. And the HDLs, the high-density lipoproteins, they take and remove cholesterol and take it back to your liver to be repurposed. Now, through decades of collecting data on people's health, we know that higher levels of LDLs are associated with higher rates of vascular disease, whereas higher levels of HDL are associated with lower rates of vascular disease, leading to healthier, longer lives. Now, you can reduce LDL concentrations and increase HDL, so you can change that ratio by exercising and limiting your intakes of animal fats and simple carbohydrates. Now, unfortunately, some people cannot regulate cholesterol through diet and exercise alone, and that's why it's important to get your cholesterol checked, because you might have to go on medications to lower your cholesterol level. So that's my plug. Go get your cholesterols checked. Let's move on to proteins. You know, these are the workhorses of life. They can perform a wide variety of functions. Now, we don't even know how many proteins are in the world, and the estimates are like in the millions, and each one performs a unique task. So what can proteins do? Here's a short list. They form enzymes that speed up chemical reactions. They make small motor proteins that allows your cells to move or divide, or it allows your muscles to contract. Every movement you make is due to a muscle contraction that's done by proteins. It helps you maintain water balance by pumping electrolytes either into your cells or out of your cells. So we can't actually directly move water, so we control it by electrolyte balance. Proteins are crucial for sending nerve signals or regulating your heart. Proteins can also allow you to see light, detect color. You like the smell of pizza? Think of protein. Proteins also form collagen. And in fact, collagen is the most abundant protein in our body. Think tendons, ligaments. But collagen is also created outside of cells that hold us all together. Without collagen, we'd just be a bunch of goo on the ground, right? They also form antibodies for defense. Proteins help us store memories. They act as chemical messengers. They can affect your moods. You look into your puppy's eyes and he looks back at you and you get all those warm, fuzzy feelings. Or maybe you get those warm, fuzzy feelings when you look at your significant other. Guess what? That's a protein called oxytocin. And not only can they make you feel love, proteins are some of the most toxic chemicals known to man. Now, if proteins are the workhorses of life, then enzymes are the engines of life. You know, life depends on chemical reactions. And life is an emergent property of a complex system requiring billions of chemical reactions to occur every second of every day. And it's the enzymes that make these reactions happen. So in a way, you know, life depends on the activity of enzymes. Our cells make thousands of enzymes, and they're used to break down foods we eat or build the muscles we need. So for example, we have specific enzymes to break down different types of sugars. We have an enzyme to break down sucrose, to break down lactose. There's a whole bunch of them involved with the breakdown of glucose. When I mean a whole bunch, just the first step of cellular respiration takes 11 proteins. In fact, I think it takes about 15 to take a glucose molecule with only 6 carbons and break it down to carbon dioxide and water. Now, here's the thing. We can't directly use the proteins from the foods we eat. So you go eat a steak or some quinoa, there's protein in those foods. We can't use that protein directly. We have to break it down into their building blocks. And the building blocks of proteins are the amino acids. And all in all, life uses 20 different amino acids. And there's one other thing about these amino acids. They are all left-handed. I know. Molecules can be right-handed or left-handed. just like your hands. You know, you've got the same parts, but you can have right-handed or left-handed molecules. And all 20 amino acids used by every living organism on this planet to make millions of proteins, they're all left-handed amino acids. Does that sound like common ancestry to you? Does to me. Now, while we need 20 amino acids, our bodies can actually make about 11 of them. That leaves 9. Those are the essential amino acids. Now, essential means we have to have it, but we can't make it. So, we have to get it from our food. So, whenever you hear somebody talk about a complete protein source, that means you can get all your 20 amino acids from it. So, think eggs are a great source of protein. So is quinoa. And as any vegetarian will tell you, you can easily get all your 20 amino acids by eating a varied diet. And it's more than just rice and beans. Like I said, quinoa, spinach, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, kale, potatoes, rice, soy. These are all good sources of protein. You know, I find it fascinating that there are potentially a million different types of proteins in the world. And each one has a unique function. And that function is determined by its shape. So shape of proteins is incredibly important. Now, the way you make a protein is you take these amino acids and you stick them together in chains. And then once you get your chain made, you fold that protein into the right shape. And that's when it becomes biologically active. And if there are potentially millions of proteins, you can imagine that they come in a wide variety of sizes and shapes. For example, remember that love hormone I was telling you about, oxytocin? Because it helps you bond to your significant other and even to your dog. In addition to helping you bond to your dog or your significant other, it's also important in childbirth because it causes the uterus to contract. So if you've ever known anybody that had their labor induced and they got a shot of Pitocin, Pitocin is actually oxytocin. Now, oxytocin is a protein hormone. It is only 9 amino acids long. That is it. Now, on the other end is an extreme example called titin. And this is a protein important for muscle contractions. And it's made of about 35,000 amino acids. It is huge. Here's another interesting fact about proteins. They are all made in a cellular structure called a ribosome. So every single protein on this planet was made inside of a cell using a ribosome. And the ribosomes, they stick all those amino acids together, and then the protein will fold either on its own, or there's actually other proteins inside the cell that will help these proteins fold. Now the problem is, if a protein loses its shape, we call it being denatured. And heat can cause that, a change in pH, you become too acidic, too alkaline, or even a change in salinity, these can denature your protein and they no longer function. Think about cooking an egg, right? You throw an egg in a frying pan, it goes from liquid to solid. That's denaturing. Those proteins are changing their shape. And that's why heat stroke is so scary, because if you become overheated, then the proteins in your body can denature, including the ones in your brain. And that can cause some brain damage like permanent memory loss and other loss of function. Now, our last macromolecule are the nucleic acids. You know them as DNA and RNA. And that double helical structure of DNA is one of the most iconic images in all of science. Its structure was determined in the early 1950s by Rosalind Franklin, Francis Crick, and James Watson. Although Watson and Crick went on to earn the Nobel Prize in the early 60s, unfortunately, Franklin passed away from cancer before the award was given. There's a whole backstory to how Watson and Crick didn't actually collect the data. It was Rosalind Franklin that did. So, we won't go into that one right now. Now, think about this. There are more than 2 million species of plants, animals, and fungus in the world, and over 1 million proteins. And that incredible diversity is stored in DNA. This is a nucleic acid using just 4 different building blocks called nucleotides. Now we can compare the information stored in DNA to the English language, where letters form words and words form sentences, and sentences form stories. Now, instead of 26 letters, DNA only uses 4 letters: adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine. Those are the building blocks of DNA, and the sequence of those 4 nucleotides codes for every living thing on this planet. It codes for every protein and the direction of how all those proteins are used. That's pretty wild, isn't it? And we call the sequence of DNA, in terms of how it codes for proteins or how it stores information, that's called the genetic code. And it dates to the beginning of life and has been inherited practically unchanged for 3.8 billion years. Now, what that means is the genetic code is basically universal. It's the same across all species, from bacteria to plants to fungus to fruit flies and humans. I know, isn't that wild? We have the exact same genetic code. Life speaks the same language. That means if I have a gene to make a protein, like insulin, and I cut that gene out, stick it in a bacteria, guess what? The bacteria makes insulin. And in fact, that's how we make insulin for diabetes today. And that universal genetic code, that's why we can make transgenic organisms. That's why we can make GMOs. It's incredible. Now, there are 2 types of nucleic acids. I've already mentioned them, RNA and DNA. They both use nucleotides as building blocks. Now, there's some differences between DNA and RNA related to their functions. But basically, DNA forms a large, stable molecule that stores genetic information and directs the activities of cells. RNA, DNA's cousin, is much more versatile. While it does temporarily store genetic information, it is also very important for regulating gene expression. Now, gene expression, that's where you take the information stored in DNA and you make proteins out of it. That's gene expression. And of course, it's DNA that forms a double helical structure. Now, what we mean by that is DNA is actually 2 strands of nucleotides. So you could imagine your nucleotides on one strand go G, A, T, T, A, C, A. That'd be guanine, adenine, thymine, thymine, adenine, cytosine, adenine. Gattaca. Wow, that's a great movie. We should all watch it. And then it's got another strand attached to it by hydrogen bonds. And then another way to think about your DNA molecule is imagine a ladder. And the rungs of the ladder are your nitrogenous bases. That's your adenine, your thymine, your guanine, and your cytosine. And those nitrogenous bases, they're forming the rung of the ladder. And of course, they're attached to a sugar and a phosphate. And those sugars and phosphates form a sugar phosphate backbone. And that's held together by stronger covalent bonds. So when you take DNA and it's a double-stranded molecule, you can easily pull the 2 strands apart. They're only held together by hydrogen bonds between the nitrogenous bases. But each strand is held together by much stronger covalent bonds forming the sugar phosphate backbone. Now in humans, we have over 3 billion base pairs of DNA. Now that base pair is our nitrogenous bases. Remember, they come together in the middle of our DNA double helix and they form hydrogen bonds, but it's not random. You see, adenine always forms 2 hydrogen bonds with thymine and guanine always forms 3 hydrogen bonds with cytosine, okay? So whenever you have an AT, that's a base pair. Now humans, we have like 3 billion base pairs and it's chopped up into 23 chromosomes. You may have heard we had 46 chromosomes. That's because we actually have 2 pairs of each chromosome. And if I took all the DNA inside of a single cell out of you, it would be nearly 2 meters in length. Now here's another little statistic I like to throw out at you. Each human has about 20 trillion cells. So if I multiply 2 meters times 20 trillion, that comes out to 40 trillion meters of DNA. Now, if I were to take that and stretch it out, it would go way past our solar system, past Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune. And in fact, it'd be so far away, it'd be past the Voyager 2 spacecraft that was launched in 1977, traveling at 15 miles per second. Isn't that amazing? That's how much DNA is stored inside of your body. Okay, so we know that DNA stores information, but RNA is this really versatile molecule that not only stores genetic information, it can cause chemical reactions, and it can regulate gene expression. Once again, form and function. First, RNA is a single-stranded molecule, and like proteins, it can be folded into many different shapes. Different shapes allow it to have more functions. That's pretty cool. Now, 60 years after discovery of DNA, we are still discovering new functions of this molecule. And in fact, like 30 scientists have been awarded the Nobel Prize for work on RNA. That's amazing. So here's some of the many functions of RNA inside of our cells. First of all, it can form messenger RNA, mRNA. This is a type of RNA that carries genetic information from the DNA to the ribosomes. There's another type of RNA called a transfer RNA or a tRNA, which brings amino acids to the ribosome. And then there's ribosomal RNA or rRNA that is involved with making the ribosome. And it's a ribosomal RNA that actually links amino acids together to form proteins. Isn't that amazing? So there's just three different functions of RNA inside of our cells. And in fact, there are multiple other types of RNA involved with the fine-tuning of gene expression. And in fact, one of the reasons why humans are so complex is because of our RNAs. In addition to being single-stranded, there's something that we've all been told to memorize as differences between RNA and DNA. The single strand is important because it allows it to assume these different shapes. But DNA, which stands for deoxyribonucleic acid, D means without, oxy means oxygen. What happens is DNA is missing a oxygen on its sugar that makes it a little bit more stable, whereas RNA is a ribonucleic acid for a ribosugar. These are 5 carbon sugars. It's a little bit less stable, and that's okay. RNA gets turned over more quickly. And we've also been told that RNA uses uracil over thymine. Why would it do that? The reason why is thymine is more stable, but it costs more to make. Uracil is cheaper to make, but uracil can switch to cytosine pretty easily. Now think about this, your DNA, your long-term source of storage, you don't want anything changing from a thymine to a cytosine. You don't want things switching around because that would be a mutation. And not only would it be a mutation, your cell wouldn't be able to recognize it as a mutation. RNA is a much shorter-lived molecule. So hey, if a uracil switches to cytosine, it's no big deal. It's a one-off. You just degrade your RNA back down into its building block nucleotides and rebuild it if you need to. So that's why those other differences are important, but not nearly as much as it being single-stranded, allowing it to take on many different shapes. Now, lastly, there are some of these organic molecules that don't fit neatly into one of the 4 groups of macromolecules. And these are the vitamins and pigments. Now, we need about 13 different vitamins. These are essential nutrients, not to be confused with essential oils, but we require small amounts of them. Now, we can't make them. Now, vitamins are organic molecules, so I'm not going to include minerals, electrolytes. Now, vitamins can be fat-soluble, which are hydrophobic, or they can be water-soluble, which are hydrophilic. Now, each vitamin might have several different functions within our cells, and one of the areas of current research is trying to figure out all the different functions of each vitamin in our cell. Now, the way you get your vitamins is have a varied diet. And one of the best pieces of advice I can give is eat your colors. Lots of different colors of fruits and vegetables. In addition to vitamin, there are also pigments. These are organic molecules with a specific color, and they serve different purposes. So the green pigment chlorophyll that's used by plants to capture energy and sunlight and stored in carbohydrates. And some people say that chlorophyll is one of the most important molecules on the planet because every bit of energy you have, every carbon atom in your body was fixed by a plant using chlorophyll. So chlorophyll helps form the basis of all of our food webs. Pretty important stuff. Another one that we're familiar with is melanin. Melanin is a pigment in our skin cells. And in fact, we have cells called melanocytes. If you get out in the sun, you can start to tan. That's turning brown. That's your melanocytes, site meaning cell, which starts producing melanin, this dark pigment, to protect your cells from ultraviolet light. So that's what getting a tan is. You're just ramping up melanin production. And in fact, when you look at people throughout the world, you'll notice that people living closer to the equator are darker. And that's because they produce more melanin to protect their skin against ultraviolet light. As you move northward, people get lighter and lighter and lighter. They get blonde hair, blue eyes, light-colored skin. Those are caused by mutations that knock out melanin production. And that's an adaptation to less sunlight. Now, other pigments are like carotenoids. This gives carrots their bright orange color. And they're related to things like beta carotene, vitamin A complex. Very important for eyesight. Do you like blueberries? I know I do. I really think they're beautiful fruits too. And that deep blue pigment found in flowers and in fruits, that's called anthocyanin. Antho means plant, and cyanin means like a deep blue color. And these have antioxidant properties. So, like I said earlier, don't fall for the chemophobia. Don't be afraid of it just because you've never heard of anthocyanin. It's actually potentially good for you. Now, determining the exact role of pigments and vitamins in our body and how they confer health benefits is an active area of research. And I can tell you that eating healthy is the best way to get your vitamins. Well, I hope I didn't cause too much stress with this little chemistry lesson today, but I hope you came away with a little bit of an appreciation for the importance of just a tad bit of chemistry in our lives and why it's important for things like our health and our nutrition. And until next time, this is Tom Sycast.